This is a recording of Claude B. from Calabasas, California, taped at the Saturday Night Live speaker meeting in Visalia, California, on Saturday, May 15, 1993, in observance with the 11 traditions stating anonymity at the public level. Please keep this safe within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
Introduce our main speaker, Claude B. from Calabasas.
Well, I am Claude, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a puker by trade, and I drank in blackouts for 16 and a half years, and until I'd had about all the fun I could endure, you know. I just couldn't handle any more fun. I just about funned myself to death. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous right after that, quite by accident. Strictly a mistake, you know. I don't know how it happened. Thank you. And I went to my first meeting at the... Well, I got drug off to a meeting is what happened. And they asked for newcomers, and this guy put my hand up for me, you know. You know how they get that hand under your elbow and get it up there? And once it's up, you can't take it down. You're stuck. It's... I have now caught alcoholism, you know. I've been in amongst these people, and I had it all of a sudden, you know. You can't backtrack once you've raised your hand, you know. It's a, what they used to say, you can turn a cucumber into a pickle, but you can't go in reverse, you know. Once it's a pickle, it's always a pickle. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the very first meeting I ever went to, the one I told you about before where I went because I was an alcoholic and didn't know it, that was in early in September of 1970. And for the grace of God, I haven't had a drink since that meeting. I got close a couple of times when I was new, but I got the old nickel therapy out and did what those people told me to do, and I haven't had to take a drink. It's, you know, when I got here, I didn't even want to cut down. I had no idea I was going to be sober 22 and a half years, you know. That's a long time between drinks, you know. I got to look at it that way, you know. I still am not drinking today, you know. The very first AA meeting I ever went to, though, was... Gosh, I was a sailor having a good time. I was about 19. And I had sold my car right before I went to service because I knew I was going to be in those faraway places, you know, like Long Beach and San Diego. I had no idea the tin can I was going to get attached to was in dry dock, you know, and I was stuck down there without a car. My folks lived in the San Fernando Valley, and I was hitchhiking up on the weekends when I had liberty, and I borrowed Mom's car a few times, and then I got this 96-hour pass where I was going to be, you know, for a whole 4 days. They were turning me loose, and I had a pocket full of money and no car, and I called home to reserve the car, and she just said no. I guess she got tired of helping me look for it. You know, I used to set up housekeeping in it, and she just needed it for transportation. Fortunately for she and I, it was one of those American automobiles with a vinyl interior that you can hose out, you know. And but she got tired of the whole routine, and she just said no. And I was kind of stuck. I got a 96-hour pass, some money, and nowhere to go, you know. And I got no brothers and sisters to prevail upon or push buttons or anything. I didn't have any friends that were stupid enough to lend me a car. And in the mid-50s, renting a car wasn't real popular. Neither my driving record nor my wallet would handle that, I'll tell you, renting a car. And I knew what I was probably going to do to it anyway, and I didn't want to rent it. So I've got my water bill. Thank you. Thank you. And I had to get myself a cup of water here when I'm going to talk to her. You know how You know how your mouth gets dry when you lie like that? Well, my sponsor taught me, he says, whenever you're going to get to a podium, you know you're going to get to a podium to read chapter 5 or give a cake or do anything, he says, make sure you're wearing a shirt and tie and a coat. And then he thought for a minute, and then he said, and pants and shoes, too. You know? He knew who I was. So now you've seen the coat. Well, I'm stuck with no wheels in this 96-hour pass. Now, all of a sudden I remembered somebody I hadn't tried in a long time. He'd been a constant source of disappointment for as long as I could remember. He's my father. And my mother had fired him when I was 6 because he was a drunk. And he lived over in Hollywood somewhere, and I dug up his phone number, called, and we exchanged social graces on the phone, and then I set myself up for a real rejection. I asked him for $20 on the car for the weekend. And he threw me a real curve. He said yes. I thought, what do I do now? And he says, look, I got something real important I got to do tonight. He says, it's a commitment, and I know I can get a ride home from there, but I'm not sure I can get a ride there. So why don't you meet me there, and you can take the car? And I said, thank you. And he gave me the address. He didn't tell me that it was a regular Thursday night Brentwood AA meeting. And I hitchhiked up there, and it was a room very much like this. The ceiling might have been a little higher. It was fluorescent lights. It was brightly lit. Everybody in there, I never seen so many teeth in my life, you know. There was a lot of smoke in that room, too, but the bright eyes, the clear eyes, and the clean breath, and the teeth, you know, and the handshakes. And I thought, Jesus, I just want the car, you know. You know, if I came in this door, my dad was about as far back in the corner as you get to, and I had to run the gauntlet, you know, of all of the handshakes. And I was wearing a Navy uniform, too, so they really welcomed me, you know. And I got the keys and the $20. We exchanged social graces, and I was about ready to bolt for the door when he asked me a very carefully worded question. He said, what's on your itinerary this evening? Well, for those of you who've never had the joy of hitchhiking, it will definitely follow up an itinerary in short order. There was a lot of spare time in blocks that evening, and I allowed, as I did have some spare time currently, he said, good, I saved a seat for you right down here. I think you really enjoy the meeting. Now, that is not a request, you know. I was just, I figured if I got the keys and the 20, I better wait this out, you know. Here about an hour, you know, so I sat there, and they got a speaker up the podium, and he introduced himself, and then he began to tell this bizarre story, and it was pretty funny, and I caught myself laughing at all the appropriate times with everybody else. And I didn't realize it then, I didn't realize it that night, and I didn't realize it until I'd been sober about a year, that I was experiencing laughter of identification that evening. I was already well into it, and, you know, I just thought it was wonderful, and it was over, and I could go on about doing what I wanted to do. And I picked up my hat and the keys, and I headed for the door, and I don't know if it was a put-up job or not, but some little old lady with blue hair and white tennis shoes came running over and waved this thing in front of me, you know? I don't know if any of you have ever seen this before, but we refer to this, is it over there on a literature table? It's called the 20 questions card. It's actually got more than 20 questions on it, but the first one is right across the top in boldface type. It's very embarrassing. It says, are you an alcoholic? I said, for Christ's sake, I'm just a sailor. I came here to pick up a car and $20. What are you waving that at me for? And she said, well, you're at an AA meeting. And I said, oh. And I forgave her, you know. And I looked at the thing. I don't know why I read it any further, but I looked at it. It says, to answer this question, are you an alcoholic? Ask yourself the following questions and answer them as honestly as you can. Well, I already got a problem with that. I mean, I'm lying about the weather, you know. My name's Bob, Bill, Joe, Jack, or anything, you know. Why tell the truth if you can BS somebody, you know? It's just pouring out of me in every orifice, you know. So I got a problem with honesty right up front. But with all the dishonesty I could muster at age 19, being a sailor, having a good time, I went through these other 20 questions. Of course, like everything else I do, you know, I look at the last page of the book first, you know. I went down to the bottom of this thing before I looked at the questions, and I see all these big yeses down here. I thought, I'm a quick study. They're looking for yeses. So I go through these 20 questions. I come up with 17 definite yeses. And then I read, and it says on the bottom, if you have answered yes, big yes, to any one of the questions, there's a definite warning that, and then in bold-faced type, it says, you may be alcoholic. If you have answered yes to any two, the chances are that you, again in bold-faced type, are an alcoholic. And then it says, if you have answered yes to bold-faced type, three or more, you are definitely an alcoholic. That's hard to misunderstand. But I submit, if you're anything like I am, you'll understand why I looked at that and I thought, who the hell put this thing together? Who's going to call the great I am an alcoholic with this drivel, you know? Well, then in fine print in parentheses on the bottom, it says the above test questions are used by Johns Hopkins University Hospital, Baltimore, Maryland, in deciding whether or not a patient's an alcoholic. Well, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but Johns Hopkins in Baltimore gets $2 million a year now from the federal government to study pigs and chickens and the weather and people like us. And their findings are considered fact. They're not selling anything. They get the money up front, and they do the studies, and this is the report. And it's a very accredited institution. The long and the short of it is this is instant credibility, and I don't like that. Because if you're anything like I am, you're looking for a way out. You got loopholes in your loopholes. Well, I reread it until I understood exactly what they meant. Without even changing the words, you know, I'm not going to change. The above test questions are used by Johns Hopkins University Hospital, Baltimore, Maryland, deciding whether or not a patient is an alcoholic. How many patients in here tonight? Yeah, just as I figured, you see? There weren't any in that room that night either. This belongs in Baltimore. This is for patients. It's that simple. It's that simple. I turned it over, and it's got another question on the back of this card. I don't know how any of us ever get past this question. It says, have you a desire to stop drinking? I got a 96-hour pass, somebody else's keys, and somebody else's money in my pocket. Frankly, I'd like to start drinking about an hour ago. You know, I want nothing else to do with that, or you, or and it's adios muchacho. I'm out of here, you know. Thank you. You're right on cue. It takes about 5 seconds for somebody to pick that up. I was born sober in New York City to a social drinking mother and an alcoholic father. And I can call him an alcoholic because I gave him his 20th cake before he passed away. I was about 6 years old when she fired him, and we ended up in Southern California. She had an English degree, which that and about a dollar will get you a cup of coffee today, you know, about a quarter then, I suppose, or a nickel. She realized that his alimony and or child support checks, if they showed up, might not clear the first go-around, and we had developed a habit of eating on a regular basis. She went to UCLA to get a teaching credential. She only took a couple of years of part-time activity in school for her to get a teaching credential to add to this degree she had, so that she could get a California teaching credential and get a job here. She decided she wanted to teach school, obviously. We were living in Westwood while she went to UCLA. I was a latchkey kid there. You know what that is. I was left to run the mean streets of Westwood, you know, all by myself. And that was a little college town with onion fields around it at the time, you know, and I guess I was probably one of the meanest things that ever hit Westwood. I was a neighborhood nuisance, you know, really. But she got her teaching credential and a contract for the city of Burbank, and which where we moved immediately, and I went to school. I did most of my schooling in Burbank. Did a lot of my drinking in Burbank, too. Started there when I was 14 and a half. I went out with the boys one Friday night, and we decided we were going to get drunk. And it was a setup, because one of the guys that I was with, his girlfriend, was babysitting at a home where the adults had just started the first round of one of those round-robin drinking affairs, and they had just left when we arrived on the scene. There was a bar with quarts and fifths of all kinds of stuff, some of which hadn't even been opened. These people were the kind of people that poured things into shot glasses, you know. I never had a use for one of those. I grabbed a hold of a bottle of something brown. I don't know what the hell it was, but it burned going down and coming up. And I just loved it. I got drunk, I passed out, I puked, and I came to with a hangover you could subdivide, you know. I don't remember in what order any of that was, except that coming to was the last thing. And I called the guy who'd been driving the night before. I said, "Chuck, for God's sakes, how did I get home?" He says, "What do you mean? We were too drunk. You drove." In my first blackout. First of many, by the way. I could recall probably on the fingers of one or two hands the times that I drank and did not go into a blackout. And I am grateful for blackouts, I'll tell you. Early on, I began to wonder why I was asked to apologize for things that I knew I couldn't possibly have done. But I knew they just pinned it on me because they knew I didn't have a very good memory. And so I just apologized for stuff I knew I hadn't done and went on about it. When I was 14 and a half, I was about 4'6" and weighed about 80 pounds. Big kid. And I'm not a monster today, but I'll tell you, starting a life of drinking at that age and that size is not easy. My mother didn't keep any of it in the home, and I discovered that when you go to liquor stores and supermarkets and stuff and say, "Give me a case of Burgundy," you know, you get thrown out on your ear, you know. I got thrown through some screen doors in some places. And I also discovered something that was to come in great value on up into my life today, which is the numbers game. I'm a salesman. And, you know, if you make 100 sales calls, you're going to get a yes out of there, you know, somewhere. So I just kept getting thrown out of these liquor stores and supermarkets and bars and stuff. And once in a while, some guy would flip up and sell me this stuff, you know. And boy, I took notes. Copious notes. Are you on this shift on a regular basis, you know? What are your hours here? What days do you work, you know? And by the time I was 16 and got my first car, I had a dossier of just about the entire San Fernando Valley and surrounding areas where I could buy alcohol at any given time. And my ability to buy and procure at that age became known amongst the minor drinking set, and I was invited to many, many minor drinking forays where I was given an invitation, a shopping list, and front money if I needed it, because I always showed up with exactly what you ordered, right to the brand, you know. I knew how to tap a keg properly. I showed up early. Carried everything in. I also tested everything to make sure nobody got poisoned, you know. So by the time you guys showed up, I was already starting to really irritate the family dog or make amorous moves on somebody's fur coat, or I'd be out in the swimming pool with all the pool furniture I'd thrown in, you know, being a great sport, you know. And I would occasionally get locked up in a single bathroom now and then, when homes just had one bathroom in them. I was not too popular in those because I always spent much too much time in those bathrooms. as others' ability to procure alcohol became evident, my popularity waned. But I was still on the scene. I was always around, and I was always drinking, and I just thought I was being one of the boys. And, my mother remarried when I was about 16, and we moved out to the western part of the San Fernando Valley, and I graduated my last year. Yeah, I graduated. That's a freaky thing. I don't know how that happened, but I did. I graduated from this school. Got a diploma, high school diploma, and my mother and my new stepdad and my father ganged up and decided that I was going to college. They hadn't consulted me. I figured I'd just been through 12 years of grueling upper-level education and I needed a rest. You know, I figured 4 or 5 years at Zuma Beach on the wall with some beer to sort things out, you know, would be appropriate. But they tricked me into taking an entrance exam, which I did quite well on. They didn't tell me that's what it was. It's just a test. I kind of did great on tests. Life was a bitch, but I did great on tests, you know. Very important question. What time am I supposed to get off of here? 9:30. No souls saved after 9:30. Okay. All the old timers can relax. I'll be off of here at 9:30 or sooner. I'm passing the entrance exam, and my folks took me over to this college and said it was registration. They didn't tell me that. They said, "We think you can put a class schedule together in here today as if you were really going to go. Why don't you go gather some information and see what it looks like?" So I got all of this stuff together, and I put a class schedule together as if I was really going to go. And they bundled it up and figured out how much money was required. It wasn't much. It was a state junior college. Sent it in, and I was enrolled in college. And they told me afterwards, and I was disappointed, but what the hell. I'll give it a shot. Paid for. I went to school, and the fortunate thing is I had put this class schedule together exactly as if I want the way I would have if I wanted to go, which meant I had a 2 to 2.5 hour lunch break, because I'm a thirsty little bugger at lunch, you know. And this liquor store, one of the most popular places for me to buy alcohol, this liquor store was about as close to this college campus as the state law would allow. It was walking distance, and it was a drive on campus. And, man, I was over there at lunch every day getting my lunch, you know, which is 4 or 5 quarts of beer, you know, because I'm thirsty. It's a hot summer San Fernando Valley day. I mean, what the heck? Oh, if I needed a little nourishment, you know, I'd throw in a Slim Jim or a pepperoni stick, you know. Something to give you a breath of 1,000 camels about 2 o'clock, you know. And I'd roll back into this campus, and I'd just stumble. You know, that college transformed after lunch. All the classrooms looked alike. The buildings were all gray, and the rooms all started with 10-something, you know. So I just slip into a room and find a cool desk to rest my head on, and I start to snore immediately. I didn't know that, but the rest of the class did, and I was invited to leave rather bodily. On many occasions, I was thrown out of an awful lot of classes in which I was not enrolled, and several of which I was, and my grades were a bit of a mixed bag, I'll tell you, at the end of that first semester, and I had embarrassed myself sufficiently. I promised myself this would not happen to me again next semester. And the only way I fulfilled this promise to myself was by enlisting in the Navy. You know, I got the hell out of college and got into the service. Shortly after boot camp, I realized I'd made yet another in a series of bad judgment decisions. Those guys were rough on me. And after boot camp, I was given a shipboard assignment and an ID and a Liberty card and told I had to be back on board ship at 07:30 on Monday. You know, all these rules and regulations, that's not my style, you know. But there wasn't a way I could flunk or withdraw from Navy. I was stuck there for a commitment, you know. And, I managed to skid through for a while, and then, you know what happened. I started using 0730 and Monday as coordinates because of the my blackout. You know, I never knew what the hell day it was when I came to, and you know what happened eventually. I came back at just right at 07:30, only it was Tuesday. I just missed it by a day, you know. And they were ready for me, I'll tell you. And I didn't understand, what's the big deal? You know, I just missed it by a day. I'm right on time, you know. And they're talking about captain's mast and reduction of pay and breaking ranks. There's all of this. I said, wait a minute. What am I going to do? Miss ship's movement? We're in dry dock. You know, we're not going anywhere, for God's sake. They didn't see it my way at all. I was on report, and I was about ready to go to captain's mast when I found a racket that was open. And I applied for it, and my aptitudes just fit perfectly. I became one of the ship's paymasters. And they don't fool with you when you're the paymaster. That's, you know, you may be only an E3, but you got the keys to everything, including your pay record. You know, and I did well in that job. There should have been three or four people between me and the dispersing officer, because I was the junior grade, but they were Filipino guys that had put in more time in the service than, I don't know, they had accumulated more leave time than I had left in my enlistment. And they were all off on leave. And it was just me and this little dispersing officer, and he drank like I did and recovered worse. And I started taking care of him in the mornings. I'd get him his coffee and get him sorted out. And I'd been on Liberty for the weekend, and I'd give him my Liberty card back. And he said, oh, he said, I got so much to keep track of. Why don't you just hang on to that? I said, yes, sir. About 15 minutes later, we got dunked in the water. The ship came out of dry dock, and we started steaming and making up for lost time. We did about 300,000 sea miles in about 8 months over there in the West Pacific. We were doing a lot of plane guard detail and just all over the place. And we were the squadron leader, and it was a relatively new ship, and all of the rest of the ships were these old World War II rust buckets. And we'd come in off a patrol for one of them to relieve us, and they'd start away from the pier, and one of their screws would fall off, or they'd lose both anchors, or a stack would blow, or something, and we'd just turn right around and go back out and do more patrol. And we just steamed and steamed and steamed. I guess I don't even like to go on a cruise today. I've seen enough water, you know. But the deal is, I got my own Liberty card, and every time we get near a port, man, I'm ashore with the rats. You know, and I'm gone. I don't come back until the ship's ready to leave, you know. And but I'm always there for payday, not because I want the money. I have to hold payday. And I'm taking care of paying the ship's vouchers and doing the financial returns and cutting the red tape and putting everything together. And this poor little dispersing officer, he just looked at me. I had taken to, while we were in the West Pacific, Carmen noticed the way I was drinking, and he gave me some of these little black and green Spancil pills. He said, these will help you drink better, and they were Dexamol, you know. And I'll tell you, I was a whiz. The paper went flying everywhere, you know. I did a lot of that, you know. I didn't even have glasses on then, and they were glasses slow off. But I was jumping around and doing everything, you know. And we got through that without any problems. And I got out of the service with an honorable discharge. Nobody bothered to ask me to re-enlist, and it's just as well, because I had a horse laughed at him. My folks asked me after I got my discharge if they told me I'd be welcome to move back into their home and continue my upper-level education, which sounded like it was better than working to me, so I moved back in. Now, I have to live in my folks' home with mom's rules, you know. I lasted about 10 days, you know, before I flew out of there spouting some obscenities and found my own place to stay. And I became a semester kind of guy. You've heard about people from the podium talk about being a 50-yard dash guy that leads the pack for 47 yards and sits down and watches everybody else go by, you know. No challenge left. I did that in semesters. I went to college for a semester, and I worked for a semester, and then I went back to college for a semester, and I got married for a semester, and then I went in the real estate business for a semester, and then I drank for a semester, steadily, and I just kind of lost track of things, you know, but I started having moments of clarity coming to in bad situations, trying to figure out how I'd gotten there, what had precipitated all of this action. And I kept coming to the same conclusions, and it was that I was different than everybody else. Everybody else, you know, it's hard to have a peer group when you have a superiority complex coupled with an inferiority complex. You just don't see eye to eye with anybody on anything. And I had no peer group, but I tried to identify with people that I drank with and worked with. And they didn't seem to drink like I did. And they seemed to, sometimes they'd go to the bar and have three or four drinks and go home, you know. Which just, I mean, I just assumed gone to the moon, you know. And then they'd go to work and stuff like that, you know. And I'd get stuck out in the bushes for days on end, you know. And the job I had at that time, the job I had prior to this one, I'd gotten fired for being drunk on the job, which is kind of a resume buster, you know. And especially when the defense contract administrator writes you up, you know. And I went to work for another company that was out of the area code. They hadn't bothered to call for references. And everybody that I worked for drank like or worse than I did. It was nightmarish. I hate to tell you that we were all working on the Apollo project, but that's where those parachutes came from, folks. I threw up on a few of those things, I'll tell you. But they all drank like I did and worse, and when I left that job, I actually got a commendation. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing. But I'd come to at the damnedest places. One of the last places I came to, and it was real strange. I was on a freeway overpass, and the driver's side wheels were up on the sidewalk, and the passenger side wheels were down in the street. And the key was on, but the motor was off, and the lights were on, and it was six. I was cursed with a watch that all it told me was it was six. This watch tells me that it's 9 o'clock, it's Saturday the 15th, and I'm in Visalia, you know. I needed a watch like this when I was drinking, I'll tell you. Because I was 19 the first time I bought a newspaper to find out where I was. You know, it's so much easier than asking those questions and getting those looks. Just go drop a dime and you got a newspaper. It tells you what day it is and where you are. You know, it's so easy. And, you know, I remember the first time I bought that paper. It was a Monday paper, and I was in San Pedro. I was close to the harbor, and it was Monday, and it was only six. I had an hour and a half to get back to somewhere where it would probably only take me 20 minutes. Now all I had to do was make sure that it was 6 a.m., not 6 p.m., you know. And when you drink like I do, in the places I drank, it's difficult to tell, you know, whether it's 6 a.m. or 6 p.m. In the San Fernando Valley, sometimes it's the same color and the same temperature and the same everything, you know. And when you come to on a freeway overpass like that, and, you know, first thing I did was reach out and feel the hood to see if I'd been driving recently, and I hadn't. It was cold. So I shut the key off and shut the lights off. And then I looked over, and I could see the sun over there, and the traffic was going. Now, the sun was either going up, going down, or coming up, and the traffic was either going home or going to work. And it's the same. If it had been on that side, they'd have been going this way, and I didn't know whether I was coming or going. And this happened to me on several occasions, and it's a little embarrassing, I'll tell you. And it's disheartening, you know. And I was just grateful, if you could recall it that, that I hadn't been arrested again, you know. So a lot of times I'd get in a car, or I'd start it up, and I'd drove into work and try to clean myself up, and I'd go in there, and by the time I got into the shop, I'd notice I didn't recognize any of these people. It was second shift. I'd forgotten to go home, you know. you know. And a couple of times I went home, you know, and I was walking around the kitchen, and my wife's looking at her watch, and she says, "What'd you forget?" And I guess I forgot to go to work, you know. And I turned around and... My sponsor says, "We sure have to give up a lot to live like this, you know." The last couple of years of my drinking were much worse than that. I really didn't know whether I was coming or going. And I'd gotten a better job, believe it or not. Somebody who'd known me while I was in the real estate business, obviously not too well. I had called and asked me to bring my license down to a Beverly Hills land operation, and I went to work there, and in short order I was in the top 10% of the sales force. I never could identify any of my customers, but their checks always cleared, and that's all they cared about, you know. I drank with my customers. I wouldn't sell anything to somebody that didn't drink. We had some marvelous outings. Some of them I remember. And I was in the top 10% of the sales force of a big company for a couple, 3 years there. And it just, I threw up better stuff more often, you know. And I got to the doctor quicker, which is, you know, my mother tried to raise me as a Christian Scientist, which means you don't go to the doctor. But boy, when you drink like I do, you got to go to the doctor. And you lie to him about what you're doing, because if you tell him what you're really doing, he'll tell you you're nuts and send you to another kind of doctor. And I didn't want to do that. I've still never talked with a... I sponsored a psychiatrist once, but I've never been to a psychiatrist to lie to him, you know? To pay him that kind of money to lie to him, you know? I mean, I can lie to my wife for nothing, you know? I want to. Not this wife. The wife I had when I was drinking. Boy, she perked up all of a sudden. But I'd gone to the doctor because I never got these kind of shakes. I got the lurches and the flyaways and the jumps and the, you know, my knees would go out from under me all of a sudden, and my voice would raise octaves, and I'd just start screaming at people all of a sudden. And I didn't really intend to do any of this stuff. They have to lock my briefcase because I threw it out on La Cienega Boulevard one day unintentionally. And I chased papers around in the traffic for a while, scared the hell out of myself. And I had to pretend like I did it as a joke, you know. Tell those people I didn't do it on purpose. They knew I was nuts. So I went to this doctor for a complete physical to find out what was wrong. I knew he'd find the brain tumor or the stomach cancer or something that would explain the behavior. Because I was getting sick every day. A lot. And it was very bloody. He gave me a complete physical, and he didn't seem to be able to find anything wrong. They took some blood, you know, and sent it to the lab. And he said, "We'll send this to the lab, and if there's any problem, we'll call you in a couple of days." And he wrote me a prescription for non-habit-forming Librium and sent me home, you know. I took that stuff as prescribed for one day and realized if I continued taking that stuff, somebody else was going to have to go to work. It wasn't going to be me, you know, because I just sat there and waited for the next pill, you know. After the third pill, and I came to in the morning, and I just put that stuff in the medicine chest and got right back into the scotch bottle because I knew that stuff wasn't going to be working for me. And about 48 hours after they gave me this physical, the doctor's office called. They said, "We'd like to talk to you as soon as possible, and don't get too near an open flame." Doctor said that there seemed to be some blood mixed up with my alcohol and cholesterol that they had pulled out of there. And I don't think I'd ingested any alcohol in my system for about 72 hours before I'd gone to that doctor, because I was in the throes of one of my three-day hangovers. I would drink, towards the end there, I would drink for 8 to 11 days. And then I would slip up, and I'd come to one morning hungover instead of still half drunk. And when you're in that hangover, the first day I would lay there. I was too sick to shake. I was too sick to do anything. I just laid there. Listened to my heartbeat, listened to my mind race, you know, for and ached, you know, for about 24 hours. The second day I'd have the brown whimpers half the day. I couldn't get too far away from the toilet or a basin. And the third day, I just was really logy, and maybe about noon if I could get a half a warm beer down, you know, or maybe, you know, taking a little nourishment like a Dorito or a chicken noodle, you know, get something going there, then I could start drinking again because I functioned when I was drinking. And I went to the doctor, and he said, "Kid, there's something really wrong with your system." He says, "I'd like to hospitalize you, but I don't know what for." He says, "What the hell are you eating and drinking?" And it scared me, so I told him. And I told him it took me a long time. I can tell you in a hot second, it was about a quart to a quart and a half a day. Plus, I'd eat about a dozen eggs spread out over the day in various forms. It went down easy. It came up easy. You know, it was working for me. And he said, "Kid, you can't drink like that." You know, and that's when he reissued the Librium, you know, which I didn't take. And I went on about my business. I mean, he said, "Kid, why don't you just have a couple? You don't have to drink like that." I almost went for his throat, you know. You bare your soul to the guy and he tells you to have a couple. I don't think there's anybody in this room that's interested in having a couple. I mean, why bother? You know, very careful. I have Tweed when she goes to the market shopping. I warn her not to get those liters of stuff because, you know, when I take the cap off, I finish it. I'm still a gulper, you know. If I make 10 cups of coffee in the morning, that's what I drink. I'm not throwing any of it away, mind you, and it's still in there. I'm going to drink it, you know. And that's the way I drank my alcohol, and yours too, if it got in the way. Preferably yours. All of yours and some of mine. And the last drunk drink that I had wasn't any different than any others. The hangover was a little wetter than usual. It was a hot September day, and I attributed it to the 90-degree temperatures. Although I had refrigerated air conditioning in my vehicle and my home, and you could have made ice cubes in either, you know. But as soon as I had my fifth or sixth shower and change of clothes, trying to get the stink off, you know, I smelled remarkably like Chivas Regal. This sweat that was coming out of me, it was really strange, and I'd gotten all the big chunks down the shower, you know. It's a good place to throw up, you know. You know, you don't have to worry about hitting your head on anything, you know. We get talented, you know, towards the end. And I had to go make some money because I was commanding a pretty good debt service. That means I owed a lot of money. That's the formal way of saying it in financial terms, you know. And I had to go out and generate some income. And generally the way I did that was by selling large property packages to lawyer and doctor consortiums that were looking for places to hide money with tax deals, and I was pretty proficient in that. And so I went out to some professional buildings that day, and as I drove in, the wheel just automatically turned and I went out. And then I drove into another place and the wheel turned and I went out of there. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. I did this for a couple of hours. What I didn't know then, and what I didn't know until I was about a year sober, was I was terror-stricken that day. I was full of the fear and anxiety that people like us are familiar with. I was familiar to the nth degree with that horrible loneliness that only people like us seem to really fully understand. And I just couldn't talk to anybody that day. I was so terror-stricken. And I'd never been like that before, and I didn't know what to make of it. And about noon, my higher power took over and stuck a dime in a phone. Phone calls were still a dime then. And I called a guy who I worked with at this land company who'd been sober for 5 years in AA. Now, my dad had been sober for 17 years in AA at this time, but I'd never learned anything from my dad, and I wasn't about to start trying, you know. I didn't want any of his action. Jim T. was what you call a program of attraction. Everybody in the company knew he was a member of AA, but that's all. He went to the social functions and the parties and the sales meetings where all the bottles were being passed around. He just said, no thanks, I got some soda water, you know. He never tried to jerk any of us off bar stools or anything. And he was just a real easy-does-it kind of guy. And so I called him. I don't know even where I got his phone number. It just appeared out of the blue. My higher power took over. I dialed this guy's number. He answered the phone. I said, Jim, this is Claude. I think I'm ready. He said, yeah, I know. We've been waiting for you. You know how you can tell when somebody's smiling ear to ear on the other end of a phone when you can't see them, you know? He says, we've been waiting for you. He says, I got to feed all safe for you. He says, why don't you come on over to the house today and go swimming? I'll feed you and take you to a meeting. It felt like somebody took about a 500-pound millstone off of my neck. I was floated out of that phone booth. I got into my car and I drove over to his house. I vibrated around his swimming pool the rest of the day. I was hung out pretty good. He got a few spinach leaves down me about 7 o'clock for dinner and whisked me over to a men's stag meeting in Encino where every alumni and graduate and current attendant of the School of Tough Love was in attendance. These guys put poles into my chest. I had bruises on my back, you know. I couldn't believe it. And this is where I came just as a visitor. I was not an alcoholic. And he raised my hand for me. And I tried to explain my position. And some of these loving gentlemen said things like, kid, why don't you shut up and listen? Why don't you take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth? You can't learn anything with your mouth open, you know? And they also threw things in there like, try it on for size. Try it for 30 days. You got nothing to lose. It doesn't cost anything, you know? They showed me the big book. They told me what was in it. They told me how to read it. How to read it, you know? They told me to read the black print, you know? They told me to start at the very first page and don't read the back one. How do they know these things? And to read all the way through it. He said, the pages are numbered for a reason. And I was insulted, but I did it their way. They told me, if you do it our way, we guarantee you that in 30 days, if you don't feel 100% better than you feel tonight, we'll be glad to refund your misery. Now, how quaint, you know. But I knew they meant it, and I didn't realize how miserable I was, you know, until I started doing, you know, I thought, well, these old fools, you know, they all had gray hair and glasses, you know, and it was amazing. You know, I was only 29 years old, you know, and boy, I was an old 29. I'd been around a lot, and it was all over for me, I felt, you know, and here I was, throwing myself on the human scrap heap, you know. AA, you know. You know, I have yet to meet anybody who comes into Alcoholics Anonymous on a Sunday morning after they throw open the French doors and listen to the birds chirping and say, oh, gosh, I think I'll go to AA today, you know. Things are so wonderful, you know. We all are feeling pretty rotten, you know, when we get here, and I didn't know how rotten I was feeling until I sobered up, you know, and I'd been sober a few days when I really realized, began to get a grasp of the situation, and I wasn't so sure I wanted to stay sober. I was sober 10 days when the obsession to drink was lifted. I am totally aware of that by several instances that I needn't get into. You know, the liquor store, for instance, right around the corner. When I left my home, I had to drive out this one cul-de-sac. There was a liquor store on the corner. No matter what direction I traveled, when I left, I had to pass, and it always called my name as I went by, and it had stopped calling my name. And I just discovered I didn't have to go into a liquor store to buy milk. I discovered I didn't have to go into a liquor store to buy gum, or I could go into a supermarket or a 7-Eleven or something, you know. And these guys really took care of me, too. They said, if you're out mowing the lawn or if you're doing anything in the hot sun, says, make sure you got a cold Coke in your hand. Because they knew I used to have a cold beer in my hand, you know. I drank beer when I wasn't drinking, you know. I drank a lot of beer. I was more of a beer drinker than anything else, I guess. I think my pocketbook was probably the command of that situation. But I was sober 10 months before I admitted to my innermost self that I was really an alcoholic and that I really belonged here and I was really in the midst of my own recovery. I didn't know it. It just came to me one day after I'd recounted some instances to some friends about some of my behavior since I'd been sober, and they said, boy, that sounds alcoholic to me. And I had to admit they were so true, you know, and I really realized what was going on. Now, I don't want to scare off any of the newcomers, but I was sober 5 years before I could spend an evening by myself and not be in bad company. You know, I went to a lot of meetings. And my sponsor made sure that I went to a lot of meetings. And I got a sponsor right away because I was embarrassed by everybody kept asking me, you got a sponsor yet? You got a sponsor yet? And I didn't know what a sponsor was. And I didn't care what a sponsor was. I just got a sponsor. So I could say, yes, I got a sponsor. You know, and then I found out what a sponsor was because he started helping me go through the steps. And he made this program fun. I mean, you people made this program fun too. But, you know, if I couldn't have fun in this deal, I'd probably go back out there and drink. This is a fun deal. Learning to live sober a day at a time and learning to live life on life's terms without the necessity of alcohol is a fun deal. I guarantee you. And fun for me. And I guess that's why I did what they told me to do. They didn't give me much chance to make decisions on my own. They made sure that my hands fit every mop and broom of every meeting I ever went to. I got dishpan hands. I got sober in the days before styrofoam, you know, when we had big stone mugs to wash. And I got drug off to hospital and institutional meetings. I got drug over to central office and put on the phones before I had a chance to say no to any of that stuff. Because I was taught early on, don't ever refuse an AA request. Don't refuse it, you know. You'll be sorry. And I saw some of my peers, or the class of 70, so to speak, that got sober, that did start refusing those requests. And I saw what happened to people like that. They got sick and drunk. And they didn't know how it happened, you know. And it was pointed out to me by my sponsor that doing things my way will get me right back to the way things were when I was doing things my way. He says, you got to do it our way. He says, we can do what I can't. You know, it's so simple. And I try not to lose track of that. When I was a year sober, somebody gave me a hospital and institutional panel that they didn't want, and I didn't want, but I was told not to refuse an AA request, so I did it. And I didn't like it for a while, but then I got to love it, and by the time a year was up, I had to go get another one because I loved the other one so much, you know? And I got involved in hospital institutional committee. I got involved in general service. I got involved in the Southern California Convention Committee. And not because I'm a joiner, because they asked me to do things because I was taught not to say no. And when Bill called and asked me to speak at this meeting in Vice City, I thought, God, that's about 67 miles beyond any length. You know? But I drove further than this to drink, so I said yes, because I don't refuse at your request. And before I get any further carried away with my own magnificence, I want to thank Bill for asking me to come up and share with you guys, because it's a privilege and an honor to participate in my own recovery. I still go to a lot of meetings, because I like Alcoholics Anonymous. I like my way of life. I was sober about 5 years when my sponsor obviously didn't understand my physical and emotional needs in the female department. You know, this woman, you know, I had found her, you know, and unfortunately I was short-circuiting emotionally every time I was around her for any period of time. And I was sitting across. Clancy was my sponsor at that time. He sponsored me from the time I was about 10 months till I was about 10 years sober. And he explained to me in no uncertain terms, he said, stay away from her. Go to meetings where she isn't. Don't go to the parties where you know she's going to be. Stay away from her. And this tool I have here, it's the only tool I've got, it's still busted, you know. It interpreted that as, buy a marriage license. You know? That's the kind of drunk I am. I see that nobody else here identifies with that kind of thinking. I survived the divorce, I'll tell you that. And it's the toughest thing I've had to do in sobriety. At 6 years, 5 or 6 years of sobriety, we managed about 10 months together before it exploded, you know. And after a couple of explosions on her side, she ended up getting drunk. She was a sober member of AA. And she's been back and forth in the program a few times, but I have no idea if she ever maintained any kind of sobriety after that. It's doubtful. And I felt very bad about that. My sponsor said to me, he says, you just have to say, thank God you stayed sober. You know, be glad it was you that stayed sober. And be grateful it wasn't you that got drunk. So, I've been working as a salesman all my life. Long about the time that marriage broke up, I got a job in the auto parts business, and I stayed in it for almost 20 years before I got fired for making too much money. And I'm in a whole different field now, trying to get restarted again. And I still go to 4 or 5 meetings a week on my own if I'm not asked to speak at a whole bunch of meetings in a row. I do get hit on every now. I guess when you get over 20 years of sobriety, the air gets a little thin up the top, and your name seems to fall off the top of the list a lot. People call, and I guess because I've developed the reputation of showing up when I get called, you know. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I get to show. I'm grateful I get called. I'm grateful I get to sponsor a bunch of goofy guys, you know. I haven't had a newcomer in a long time. Down south, we always seem to get is people that fall in after about 60 days with a $10,000 or $20,000 big book, you know. One of those institutions. I haven't seen a wet drunk or a convulsion in a meeting in a long time. I used to sell tickets for the second show at convulsions, you know. And it was great. Once again, I want to thank you guys for having me out here. I want to thank you for your hospitality and the paying the expenses, and Bill and Dottie for a wonderful meal, and you guys for a warm reception here. I'm grateful I'm still sober. I'm grateful I keep coming back. I hope you guys hang on and keep coming back too. It's a great way to live. Thank you.